Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Jack Beatty.
Every nation and every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists.
That, in plain English, is the Bush Doctrine. But behind the scenes, the future direction of this war on terrorism isn't so clear. Since the U.S. attacked Afghanistan 11 days ago, a debate has split Bush's closest advisors. Should we declare victory when the Taliban disintegrates, or if we capture bin Laden, or will this battle against terrorists drive our troops into other countries? This hour, we'll take a closer look at the policy war between the Pentagon and the State Department. First, the tensions between India and Pakistan continue to rise. Secretary of State Colin Powell was in India today attempting to cool the escalating conflict between the two countries over the disputed region of Kashmir. Against the background of Indian shelling of Pakistani military positions yesterday, Powell sought to boost support for the war against terror. I spoke earlier today with reporter Scott Baldoff, Southeast Asian bureau chief for the Christian Science Monitor. He says that Powell spent part of his mission in India clarifying remarks he made in Pakistan.
When he was in Pakistan, he said that the Kashmiri people, the people of the state of Jammu and Kashmir, should have the right of self-determination. They should have the right to decide what's in their best interest. And he also indicated that that the Kashmir issue was a central one, a central issue between India and Pakistan. Now, those are rather innocuous words to most Americans, but for Indians, it sounded as if Powell was endorsing the Pakistani viewpoint that Kashmir is a dispute. In fact, it's a disputed territory, and one that would require a vote by the Kashmiri people to decide. India, of course, regards this as an internal matter, something for the nation of India to decide.
And what did he then say in New Delhi to try to compensate for what he said in Islamabad?
Well, when he got to Delhi, he said that, in fact, he had been misquoted by the Pakistani press, which is entirely possible, that he had said it was a central issue, not necessarily the central issue between those two nations. And then he went on to talk about the need for both sides to stand down and to reduce tensions and reduce violence. India, of course, that's music to their ears. They review Pakistan as sending in a number of militant groups into Kashmir to stir up trouble. So from the Indian perspective, this helped a little bit to ease their concerns.
Mm-hmm. He also said something about terrorism, that India, that all terrorism was our enemy.
Yeah, and of course, that is where he then went on to talk about how India and the United States are natural allies against terrorism, that they mm-hmm. both are facing groups that have common links. Mm-hmm. There are apparently some links between a number of groups that operate out of Pakistan, which have trained and have bases in Afghanistan and contacts with Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network. Two groups, the Harkat al-Mujahideen and also the Jaish-e-Mohammed, have been banned now by the Pakistani government on the urgings of the United States government. But, of course, there are many groups left to be looking after.
To that question now, India has said that it will continue its punitive campaign against Pakistan-based guerrillas, this campaign flowing out of a successful suicide bomb attack on the Kashmiri summer capital of Srinagar on October 1st. Now, the guerrillas, the Pakistan-based guerrillas, have said they would step up these suicide attacks against Indian targets in Kashmir. Where is this confrontation heading? Are we looking at the possibility of a new Indo-Pakistani war here?
It's hard to say just yet where it's heading. Now, mind you, if the World Trade Center attack had not occurred, I would be in Kashmir now covering all of this. This attack was a huge one. It killed 40-some-odd people in the summer capital, as you mentioned. Now, on the other hand, there are attacks nearly every day in Kashmir. the death toll has risen from anywhere from 6 to 12 to now 20, 18 to 20 people each day in scattered attacks around that small state. And that is a level of violence that India regards as obviously not something that that the state can sustain. They've acted very strongly. They've given increased powers to the police forces there, and they are beefing up their security forces and the army presence there. And just on the eve of the Powell visit, they shelled Pakistan to show that they were not going to tolerate any more what they regard to be working together between the Pakistani army and these Mujahideen groups.
And the Mujahideen groups now say they're going to step up suicide attacks. I've heard something about the movement of Indian forces, three regiments of Indian forces moving toward the, is there something to that?
That is certainly something to be watching, the level to which they throw troops into Kashmir. Mind you, often the troops are used for, to maintain internal control, to do spot checks, to attack militant bases. Kashmir is a very agricultural and rural state. There are some major city centers, but it is a state full of villages, and the Indian Army and security forces have at best a tenuous hold on the state. So if they are sending in troops, they're largely going to be trying to crack down on those militants within, and perhaps trying to hold on to their border and perhaps keep out militants, infiltrators. Not so much of a concern of them rushing across the border into Pakistan. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there are a number of politicians in India that are calling for what they call hot pursuit rules, the ability for Indian forces to chase infiltrators who have gone into India, conducted an attack, and then slipped back across into Pakistan. If they were to give the Indian Army the ability to slip back in with the infiltrators, chase them into Pakistan, that could escalate things tremendously.
Scott Baldoff is South Asia Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to us earlier from Islamabad, Pakistan. While the U.S. continues to bomb military targets in Kabul, there's another battle brewing in Washington conference rooms between state and defense departments about where the war on terrorism should go next. Last month, Secretary of State Colin Powell convinced President Bush that our objective was clear and contained: capture Osama bin Laden, topple the Taliban, and crush the al-Qaeda network. Powell warned that further military action against Iraq, for example, would split the coalition against terrorism. But Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz and a group of like-minded hawks have argued that the U.S. must go much further. Any country that harbors terrorists is also our enemy, they argue, and the prime suspect is Iraq. We're talking this hour about the direction of the U.S. war on terrorism. Will it, should it, lead us toward a new war on Saddam Hussein? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now is Michael O'Hanlon. He's a senior fellow in foreign policy studies for the Brookings Institution. Also with us is Richard Pearl, a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He was the assistant secretary of defense under President Reagan. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Richard Pearl, you are a member of the Defense Policy Board, where you have been arguing for extending the war on terrorism to Iraq. Please make that case for our listeners.
Well, first, let me say that I'm on your program happily as an individual and not a spokesman for the Defense Policy Board or any other official institution. The president has made the case, and he's made it very clearly. He has said that this is a war against terrorism and the countries that harbor terrorists. If we don't get countries now harboring terrorists out of the business of doing so, the number of terrorists that reach our shores is going to be more than we can hope to contain using homeland defense, which we're now putting into place, the various measures that are going to affect our lives in ways that we're already beginning to see. So we have to reduce the numbers, and the only way to reduce the numbers is to get states out of the business of supporting terrorism, and Iraq is preeminent among those that do that.
Well, as you know, Secretary of State Powell has said that war on Iraq would wreck the coalition he's assembled to take on al-Qaeda. Prime Minister Tony Blair has signaled that pending conclusive proof of Iraqi participation in September 11th, Britain would not support an attack on Iraq. Turkey, our NATO ally and the largest Islamic country in the coalition, has warned against any U.S. attack on Iraq, fearing destabilization and chaos within Iraq. Our Arab coalition partners are against an attack on Iraq, fearing that it would provoke outrage within their countries that could threaten their regimes with destabilization. This would be more or less the case the State Department would make. Can you address these objections to extending the war to Iraq?
Yes, I can. We have an obligation to protect the American people. Saddam Hussein has engaged in terrorism himself, including an effort to assassinate a former president of the United States. He supports terrorism around the world. He has camps in his country in which terrorists are trained, including one camp in which they specifically train hijackers. And he already possesses and is working hard to expand his arsenal of weapons of mass destruction. Now, we can do what we did prior to September 11. We can wait until it's too late and suffer terrible consequences. And if we wait long enough, Saddam Hussein will disseminate weapons of mass destruction to terrorists eager to use them against the United States. So there's no sense preserving a coalition. There's no sense pleasing the British Prime Minister if the end result of that policy is going to be devastation in this country.
But if we have to go it alone, if we face massive demonstrations in the Arab world, wouldn't that itself contribute to terrorism?
Are we going to refrain from defending ourselves because there are demonstrators in the Arab world?
Well, not so much demonstrators, but what if it leads to destabilizations of, say, Egypt or Saudi Arabia? Is that worth the candle?
I think Egypt and Saudi Arabia are already pretty unstable. Let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. There's an inexhaustible supply of suicide bombers. We know that. We see them marching, sometimes 50 and 100 strong. There are camps all over the Arab world. I see no reason to believe that appeasing that sentiment by not defending ourselves against a known threat is going to improve our security.
Mm. Michael O'Hanlon, you've been quoted as saying that, quote, "I know of no strong evidence," end quote, that Iraq was involved in September 11th, and that in the absence of that evidence, quote, "we don't want to go to war against Iraq." Why don't we want to go to war against Iraq? We've mentioned the diplomatic risks. What about the military risks?
Well, first of all, let me say it's nice to be on your program and nice to be on the program with Assistant Secretary Pearl. And I think he makes a very solid point that if we get to the conclusion that Saddam Hussein has become a major threat to us through his links to terrorism, then I would fully agree with Mr. Pearl that we have to think about attacking Iraq, and not only that, but unseating Saddam Hussein. I mean, more than just symbolic military strikes, something quite serious, and perhaps even Desert Storm too. So for me, that's the big threshold in this is, do you have evidence to believe that Saddam Hussein is directly involved or might become directly involved with Osama bin Laden? It's one thing to support lower-grade terrorism. There are a lot of terrorist groups around the world. I don't think we have the luxury or the desire to attack each and every one and each and every country that supports them, because some of these threats are simply not nearly as serious as others. The question is Saddam Hussein implicated in the most serious terrorist organizations and activities in the world? And there, I think the evidence is no. Now, Mr. Pearl, again, I have to keep agreeing with a number of his points, because this is a serious subject. And even if I come out on the opposite side, I'm aware of the stakes. If it turns out that we've waited too long and there is a body of evidence that suggests Saddam is involved, but we want to close our eyes to that because it's more politically convenient.
Michael, can you hold that thought for just 1 second? Thank you. How far should our war on terrorism go? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Jack Beatty. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston.
From Boston University.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Jack Beatty. We're talking this hour about the battle in the White House over expanding the war on terrorism. Are you ready to send U.S. soldiers into Iraq? Can the U.S. target other countries and keep the international coalition together? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or join us online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. We're here with Michael O'Hanlon, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and Richard Pearl, a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and the Assistant Secretary of Defense under President Reagan. Michael O'Hanlon, you were about to take us into the military risks. What would our military face in a war against Iraq?
Well, I believe that the serious option, if you really think Saddam Hussein is implicated with al-Qaeda, is to unseat him, which means Desert Storm 2. That means 500,000 Americans staging through Kuwait and marching on Baghdad to overthrow Saddam. At that point, you have to assume Saddam would use his chemical and biological agents against invading American troops. He may not do it very well. He's not necessarily very proficient at that, but he would try. He would have no reason not to. We would already have declared that our goal was to topple him. So that's the risk you have to weigh against the risk that Secretary Pearl, I think, very eloquently and correctly identifies, which is what are the chances Saddam is giving weapons of mass destruction or other support to Osama bin Laden? It's a very tough judgment call. I mean, we don't have any risk-free options here. And on that point, I don't want to just make this a stark debate between myself and Mr. Pearl. He's raising some very important risks. But right now, there is simply no hard evidence to think that Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden work together. And for me, that means you can't go with this very serious option at this stage because of the huge risks associated with that particular military option.
Richard Pearl, how about that scenario of U.S. forces having chemical and biological weapons used against them?
Well, I think the scenario that Michael has laid out greatly overstates the risks that we would face. The strategy that would best be pursued would not entail anything like Desert Storm. Saddam is not in the same situation he was in at the time of Desert Storm. The objective is different. It's not to root a military force out of Kuwait. You can always describe the task in such daunting terms that there's no desire to do it. And I think that's what Michael has done. There are other strategies. I'm not going to get into a lot of detail about those strategies because I know some of them are under active consideration. But they entail much lesser risks. I think Saddam can be driven from office much more easily than a great many people think. And by the way, prior to Desert Storm, a lot of opinions were rendered about how difficult that undertaking would be. And anyone who bothers to look at the history will discover that in congressional testimony and in articles, I was pretty much right. And a great many other people who overstated Saddam's capabilities were pretty much wrong. So that's the essence of the issue. If you think the risks are modest, as I do, and you put on the other side of the balance the risk that a weapon of mass destruction could be used against the American people through Saddam's facilitating that, then you come to the conclusion I've come to. And let me just say one other thing.
Mm-hmm.
It really doesn't matter whether Saddam is involved with al-Qaeda or not. I think there's evidence that he is. But even if he isn't, we know that he supports terrorism, has engaged in terrorism himself. And the connection to September 11 or even to al-Qaeda generally is really irrelevant as you assess the risk that we might become the victims, not of an attack that kills 5,000 or 6,000 Americans, but 50,000 or 60,000 or 500,000 or 600,000.
Mr. O'Hanlon, what about the anthrax connection here? Commentators have said that
the virulence of the strain of anthrax found in the Hart office building argues state sponsorship for the terrorists and that that state might be Iraq. If that connection, what do you think of that argument, first of all? And if that connection can be made, how should the U.S. respond then?
Good questions. Let me pick up on this ongoing discussion, though, with Richard Perle for just a second. I am not trying to deliberately overstate what I think would be militarily necessary to overthrow Saddam Hussein. I am simply more cautious. Richard Perle may be correct, and I would hope he would be. But I think as a prudent military planner, and I think most military officials would agree with me on this, you have to assume you're going to have to fight hard inside Baghdad, inside the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. It may only be 100,000 or so Iraqi troops that really fight hard. It may not be the whole half-million army. And therefore, I think we would probably win this battle relatively decisively. But I think you would have to assume close to 500,000 American troops would be needed, the size
of
the Desert Storm.
Michael, we did that last time around, and half a million were irrelevant to the battle.
But they didn't have to deal with the end game of going after Baghdad.
Well, I also want to agree, Richard, I know there are things I'm saying you don't agree with, but let me just say one thing that I do agree with you on, which is that the casualties from this operation would, I think, to the United States, be no greater than those that we suffered in the World Trade Center bombing. So to the extent that you're right, that the next time we're attacked, we could be the victims of 50 or 60,000 Americans killed. And to the extent Saddam would contribute to that, then I think the risks of the military operation, even the one I've described, are probably less. So in that sense, I am not trying to paint something that's so stark as to be unthinkable. I'm trying to be realistic. To hope the Iraqi opposition is going to topple Saddam Hussein is very optimistic, and I would challenge you to back that up with any serious evidence about the quality of that opposition. But even if you take my position, I would acknowledge this war is something we can do. I just think we would lose several thousand people in the process, and it's a pretty serious proposition.
Let's take some callers here. David is on the line. Hello.
Yes, evening, Jack.
Evening.
Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm afraid my remarks are going to be a little incoherent. Just tuning in your program, I couldn't resist grabbing up the phone because I felt that I was listening to Vietnam Redux, listening to conversations in 1965, for example, by McGeorge Bundy, telling us how we had to get into Vietnam, the various good and irrefutable reasons, which turned out, of course, to be just vaporisms. And these two gentlemen, too. Listen, one of the phrases you used to your listeners, can you give reasons why we shouldn't get into a fight with Saddam? I used to think that before you went into a war, you had to have an argument for getting into a war. Now it's gotten to the point where what are the arguments for staying out of a war? I mean, first, I'm a great skeptic in this whole matter. Mm-hmm. We talk about a war on terrorism and liken September 11th to Pearl Harbor Day. Mm-hmm. But after Pearl Harbor Day, we had a definite enemy, Japan, places you could bomb, places you could invade, and the same for Germany. But the war on terrorism, there's no clear-cut enemy. It's ill-defined. It's capable of indefinite expansion, as we see in the program mm-hmm. that you're conducting now. And it is just made to order for those forces on the home front who wish to maintain a Cold War and start a new Cold War. That's what's happening. But it's a Cold War that's even more insidious than the old one because there's no end predictable in it, mm-hmm. and there's no clear-cut enemy.
Well, let's put that to Richard Perle. A new Vietnam, Richard Perle?
Well, let me say the caller's right by confessing his incoherence at the outset.
Well, I didn't find him incoherent.
The fact that McGeorge Bundy made statements 25 years ago that turned out to be wrong has nothing to do with the issue we're discussing today. And your caller makes the point that that terrorists are hard to find, which is precisely why we have to go after the governments that harbor terrorists, because we can't find them most of the time. As we know from bitter experience, many of them are prepared to commit suicide in order simply to kill Americans. And so the only feasible strategy entails depriving them of sanctuary and the support that they need in order to develop sophisticated means and reach our territory.
Hmm. Joining us now is Paul Rogers. He's a professor of peace studies at the University of Bradford in England, and he's the author of Losing Control: Global Security in the 21st Century. Thank you for joining us, Paul Rogers.
Hello, good evening.
Have you been hearing our conversation?
I've heard the last 10 minutes, certainly, yes.
Well, where do you come in on this, and more specifically, where does Tony Blair and the British Parliament stand on the extend the war to Iraq proposition?
If we take those separately, I think Tony Blair, at least privately, would be concerned at an extension of the war to Iraq. I think the British Parliament would be more generally antagonistic and very concerned about it, and I think that would extend through most Western European countries. I think personally there are probably two issues. One is that one of the lessons of the Gulf War was that, in a sense, there were two wars being fought. One was to evict the Iraqis from Kuwait, which was very successful for the coalition. The other was for the survival of the regime, and that was the war largely fought by Saddam, who, of course, had hardly any of his elite forces anywhere near the theater of war. And he succeeded in that. And I think if there was any kind of major military action against the regime, which threatened the regime, then I'd agree with Michael O'Hanlon, it would likely escalate. But I think the other feature, which we're perhaps tending to forget, is that any kind of approach to that kind of military conflict would cause huge upheavals in Saudi Arabia. And I think the Saudi government itself would be extremely agitated if there was to be any realistic risk of a war with Iraq, so much so that I would guess, and admittedly this is from the other side of the Atlantic, that within the United States it is unlikely that the U.S. will pursue such a policy. But at the same time, what in my view is likely is that at some time in the next few weeks, the Saddam Hussein regime will do its best to provoke just such an eventuality.
Why would it do that?
Essentially because it recognizes that any kind of provocation which results in any reasonably forceful U.S. action against the Iraqi regime will cause massive problems for the Saudi authorities within their own country, possibly even leading to destabilization. And I think the Saddam Hussein regime would see this as an opportunity essentially to present a kind of second front while the United States was obviously intensely occupied with the war in Afghanistan. At this sort of time, I think it would be within the kind of behavior you would expect of the regime to do that as a route to the possible destabilization or at least instability in Saudi Arabia.
Richard Pearl, how about that scenario?
Well, it's entirely possible that there will be instability in Saudi Arabia. I think Saudi Arabia is already unstable and could go at any moment by a coup or a variety of other means. But what this gentleman, like others, are saying is that we should wait for Saddam to do whatever he chooses to do against us, take no action against him now, and hope for the best. And the lesson of history is that when there is a predictable threat of the magnitude of the threat Saddam poses to the United States, it is unwise to simply wait and hope that he doesn't take action, because he will take action.
Hmm. Michael O'Hanlon?
Well, generally we do wait. We've outwaited the Soviets and we won the Cold War by waiting. We've outwaited the North Koreans, and let's hope there's going to be continued progress there. But again, you know, I accept the basic principle that Richard Pearl has articulated, which is if we become convinced that Saddam Hussein is posing a serious threat to the United States through his ties to al-Qaeda, we have to act in our own self-defense. I accept that principle. To me, the question is the evidence that backs up the claim that there is such a link, and I am dubious. On the one hand, I am worried because Saddam did try to assassinate President Bush in 1993, and that suggests that this man's appetite for vengeance may be such that he will do things that risk his own suicide, essentially. On the other hand, almost all of his other actions in the last 10 years have taken him to the precipice of confrontation with the United States, and then he's backed down because he has a strong self-preservation instinct. And I think, like most evil men that we've managed to deter and face against in the last 50 years, Saddam is a person we can contain and deter. However, I want to see all the evidence as it comes in, and I'm willing to change my mind at the first compelling sign of major Iraqi involvement with al-Qaeda. We cannot wait, as Richard says, for a fully developed case, because that might be too late. But I want to see some evidence. I think Saddam is going to avoid suicide, and therefore I don't want to go to war with him at present.
Michael, let me raise 2 points. You assume that he would be risking suicide. without any reason to believe that if he were simply to disseminate weapons of mass destruction to other terrorists, we would respond by an action against him that would constitute suicide. I see no reason to believe that, first of all. And secondly, I think you're defining the standard we should apply in assessing the threat that Saddam poses too narrowly. You keep linking it to al-Qaeda. But al-Qaeda is not alone in carrying out acts of terror against the United States. It is unlikely, under the best of circumstances, that all of the terror networks, and they have links to one another, are going to disappear with the outcome of the current operation in Afghanistan. So I think it's reasonable to assume that there will continue to be suicidal terrorists, and Saddam is in a position to supply them with the thing they don't now have, which is weapons of mass destruction.
Paul Rogers, how about that? An inexhaustible supply of suicide bombers who can be supplied through Iraq.
That's certainly possible. I think myself that it's pretty unlikely that the Saddam Hussein regime is actually in this business. I think there may well be other routes, simply because of the dangers to the regime itself. But if I could just follow through on one of the earlier issues.
Sure.
With Richard Pearl, and that is, in particular, if we do face the prospect at some stage in the relatively near future of the severe destabilization of Saudi Arabia, whether or not in relation to action taken against or by Iraq, that could certainly threaten in a very serious way oil supplies. I would be interested to know, Richard, whether you feel that it would then be appropriate for Western forces to maintain control of the West Gulf oil fields to actually ensure security of supply.
Well, if we were in a position where supply was cut off and the collapse of the Western economies were in prospect, I think we might have to consider that. But I see no reason to believe that a successor regime to the current Saudi regime would decide to starve rather than put oil on the world market.
Not even a somewhat anti-Western Islamist regime?
Well, you've got anti-Western Islamist regimes in a number of countries that are quite happy to sell oil and keep the revenue. They're not going to bankrupt themselves in order to make a point. Oil is fungible. It's hard to imagine a more anti-Western regime than Iran, which has been cheerfully selling oil all through the period of its characterization of the United States as the Great Satan.
But essentially, if there was the kind of instability, even short-term, then you would regard it as reasonable action to safeguard supplies.
Well, I think there are a number of things that can be done short of, if you're implying that we would seize Saudi oil fields, I think it's way premature to design a solution to a problem that doesn't exist. At the moment, because of the current state of the world economy, we could actually get along without significant quantities of oil that are now being pumped. And there is excess capacity in other countries who would be happy to fill in, particularly if prices were to rise. So
hold that thought, Richard Pearl, just for a second, please. Thank you. Paul Rogers, I want to thank you for joining us. Paul Rogers is a professor of peace studies at the University of Bradford in England. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or get into the conversation online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Jack Beatty. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Jack Beatty. We're talking about the debate between the State and Defense Departments over the scope of the war on terrorism. Will victory over Osama bin Laden and the Taliban be enough to win the war on terrorism, or must we extend it to other countries? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Kit is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question for one of your guests, Mr. Beatty, for Mr. Pearl.
Yes.
He's suggesting that we need to go maybe after Iraq, but what happens when we find out that there are other countries like Libya, Pakistan, Sudan, Iran, they're all harboring terrorists? So are we going to go at war with all of these countries?
Richard Pearl?
Well, I think that if we change the situation that now prevails, it will not be necessary to do that. And the situation that now prevails is simply this. There is no serious cost attached to being a supporter of international terrorism. The states you mentioned and others have been supporting terrorism, and they've paid no price for that. The benefits they get, in most cases, I think, are really quite meager. But because there's been no cost, even meager benefits have been justified in the eyes of the decision makers in those countries. If we now impose a cost, if we say to them, if you support international terrorism, if you harbor these people, if you give them money and technology and logistics and communications and documentation and all the other things that make it possible for them to do what they do, if you do that, then we're coming after you, and you are at risk, and your regime may disappear. I think a number of these countries will simply stop doing it because it will no longer be in their interest.
Michael O'Hanlon, will a sort of a tutelary lesson here and punishment from the United States be enough to dissuade these other countries from doing what they're doing?
Well, I don't deny that there is some benefit to holding a sword of Damocles over people, but I think in general you really need cooperation from most of the countries that were just mentioned, and you need to be very judicious with the threats. However, there are cases where military force may be needed outside of Afghanistan, and so instead of just sounding like a person who opposes that, let me give the circumstances under which I would support it. I think if you can identify a group that is linked to al-Qaeda or comparably bad, even if on a smaller scale, such as Abu Sayyaf in the Philippines or the Egyptian Islamic Jihad in Egypt, and you can identify the assets and the locations of those organizations, and you can help their own governments perhaps pursue them, if you have cooperative governments like Egypt or the Philippines in these two cases, under those circumstances, we should be prepared to use air power, special forces, intelligence, and so forth. And this should be, in some sense, a broader campaign than simply within Afghanistan. I just draw the line at actually attacking the states that have some limited complicity in less dangerous organizations. Now, there may be a gray area where you have, as Richard mentioned earlier, there are some organizations that are pretty darn dangerous, even if they're not quite as much a dire and direct threat to the United States as al-Qaeda, and where governments have been supporting or harboring terrorists in a more active way than Egypt or the Philippines with the two cases I mentioned. Those are tough cases, but there aren't very many of them. Libya, Syria, Sudan, these are already countries that have been getting out of the terrorist business, I think largely because they have economic incentives to, because we put sanctions on them, not just because we threaten them with military force. So I think there may be a role for this, but it's a very limited role.
And hasn't Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld basically said, well, if you get out of the terrorism business post September 11th, the slate will be clean so far as we're concerned. Is that, doesn't that sort of say to these countries, you don't have to wait till we destroy Iraq to get the message. You get the message now. Stop doing what you're doing, and we'll bring you no harm. What about that, Richard Pearl? Isn't that?
Well, I think that's fine. I don't believe we should use force when force is not necessary. If we can talk them out of it, that's great. If we can sit down with them and reason with them, I think that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. That's the best way to do it. Mm-hmm. But I think there are some hard cases here, and Iraq clearly is one of those hard cases.
Mm-hmm. Hard to imagine sitting down and talking to Saddam. Bernie is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
Right now we have one mission, and that is to get Osama bin Laden and his organization out of the picture. Now, President Bush already made it very clear that if you're helping that or supporting that, then you're in danger of being taken too. I remember an old preacher man told me one time, he says, if you're not running with running from the devil, you're running with them. And since we've been children, we've known there's right and there's wrong. There's good and there's bad. There's good and there's evil. It's our duty as civilized human beings in the United States to take care of the evil and clear the world of it. Now, what countries we have to go after, that will all come out in the picture, because like any gang in L.A. or something, if you take down the first few people, then the gang just has a way of crawling back into the gutter.
But clear the world of evil, isn't that a messianic objective, Bernie? I mean,
I don't mean it as messianic. I mean it as you should treat your fellow human beings in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, flying two planes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and attempting to, who knows where that other plane was going, mm-hmm. that's not treating people the way that you should. Mm-hmm. Whether you believe in God or not, there's a way to treat human beings.
Mm-hmm. And that certainly isn't the way. Well, you're quite right on that. Thank you. Let's take a call from Bill. Bill, hello.
Hello.
Welcome. Your question,
hi there,
please.
How are you?
Fine.
I think as Americans, we tend to underestimate the evil that people like Hitler and Pol Pot and Saddam Hussein are capable of. I don't think that there's any way that you can appease people like this. You can look back at history and say, well, maybe if we had gotten involved in World War II when Hitler invaded Poland, there wouldn't have been as large or maybe any World War II in Europe. Mm-hmm. This guy is trying to kill us. I don't think he leaves us much of a choice. We've got to eliminate him.
And you say he's trying to kill us. You're then assuming that he was involved in September 11th, or are you just sort of positing a general antagonism that he has toward us?
I think it's irrelevant whether he was or not involved in the September 11th or if he has any connection to Al-Qaeda. I think that it's obvious that he threw out the UN inspectors. Why did he do that? He is developing weapons of mass destruction. That's not a secret. He hates the United States, and he would just as soon detonate a nuclear bomb in Manhattan as spread anthrax. I think if we wait and if we appease him, that we are really increasing our risk. And I think that we've got to get him out of self-defense.
So you agree with Richard Pearl. How about that, Michael O'Hanlon?
Well, it's a powerful argument, and I would not deny that Saddam is as evil as Pol Pot or Adolf Hitler. I actually agree with that point. I just think that in this case, our military force is very strongly and credibly conveyed a message to Saddam, and it's not going to go away. He knows it. He knows we would come after him if he were ever caught doing anything along these lines. We're not going to appease him. That's simply not one of the options being considered. One option is to continue the containment. The other option is to consider overthrow. Those are the two options being considered, not appeasement.
But, Michael, suppose Saddam gives biological agents to terrorists. There are no fingerprints on it. We can't prove where it came from. And suppose those biological agents are then used to kill tens or hundreds of thousands of Americans. What's to inhibit Saddam, whose passion for revenge is well known and well understood?
It's a good question. I think, first of all, that conveying the biological material, transferring it from Iraq to Al-Qaeda, is more than simply something one man can easily do. You're talking about technology needed to disperse that capability in the United States. We've seen this week, this last 10 days or so, what happens when you have anthrax but no way to properly disseminate it. You kill one person, you terrorize a population, but you don't cause the kinds of casualties you just mentioned. If Saddam wants to kill tens or hundreds of thousands of Americans through Al-Qaeda and biological weapons, he's going to need to do a lot more work with that organization to prepare them technically and give them the equipment. I think there's a very good chance we would see that. I grant your point.
With the same CIA that saw September 11 coming is going to see it?
Hmm. Well, go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to say that many people who are arguing we should go after Saddam are basing their case on things the CIA has found out, meetings the CIA knew about. And I would acknowledge there have been perhaps half a dozen meetings between Iraqis and Al-Qaeda members over the years. But those have been isolated individual meetings with one or two people involved, not major transfers of equipment. We have no reason to think there is that going on, and we have every reason to think that Saddam preserves and wants to preserve his own skin. I take your point. There's some uncertainty in this argument because we don't know for sure what's happening that we don't know. On the other hand, if you start overthrowing Saddam without any evidence, first of all, I think he may use chem bioagent against the United States then. He may transfer those agents at that point to Al-Qaeda, even if he hasn't done so before, and you lose the coalition that you've got now, and there's no evidence to back it up. So it's a tough argument. I see your point, but without any evidence at all of any real link here, I think we have to be patient.
We're asking how far the war on terrorism should go with Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and Richard Pearl, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Jim, and we're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Jim is on the line. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Well, we're fine. Welcome.
Thank you for taking the call. The quick question I have is, there is the military action I think is appropriate at this stage of the game, but I hearken back to Tony Blair's speech, which was shortly after the 11th, I believe about a week after the 11th, where he outlined a broader foreign policy change that maybe needs to be made. I'll call it a more of a Marshall Plan for the world, which was getting to perhaps some of the root cause of the hatred and the like. And that speech that Tony Blair gave, I think, provides a broader outline to solving some of the core issues instead of some of the symptoms, which the military actually gets to. And I'm curious, do your speakers believe, or your guests believe, that there are fundamental foreign policy changes or direction in foreign policy in addition to resolving and attacking direct terrorist threats, which I believe is appropriate? How do you get to the root cause issues, and do we have foreign policy issues that are wrong, that are causing some of this hatred towards us?
Thanks for that, Jim. Richard Pearl, how about that? The Marshall Plan idea of Tony Blair's, the vision of a sort of lasting good, as he put it, to come out of this war on terrorism.
Well, I think that's a little squirrely, if I can say so. I'm not sure that there's any significant relationship between whatever grievances may be felt in whatever parts of the Arab world and the activities of Osama bin Laden. It seems to me, and there's evidence in his own words to support this, that bin Laden's principal objective is to take over Saudi Arabia. I think he wants the wealth. I think he wants the power. And while he may induce people to commit suicide in supporting him, dealing with the root causes is not going to stop him any more than dealing with root causes would have stopped Adolf Hitler.
Let's take another call from another Jim. Hello, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. If you could be quick, please.
Sure. I think an interesting question is, how do you define terrorism?
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, there are people in the United States that support certain Irish groups. And are you going to take action against them?
And there's Hamas, of course.
Or if this was a few years ago, not a few decades ago, what about Irgun?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
of course, we should take action against the IRA. Organizations that kill innocent civilians are engaged in terrorism. And if civilization can do anything in this millennium, it ought to be to make the killing of innocent civilians inadmissible, unacceptable.
But what if that campaign against terrorism requires the killing of yet more innocent civilians, as they're dying now in Afghanistan? At what point does the moral calculus balance out?
Well, we are there. First of all, there is a difference, a fundamental difference, between a war against civilians and a war in which civilians may be killed as a byproduct of action against terrorists. And it's regrettable, and we go to enormous lengths to minimize civilian casualties. But if we are going to say that we can never take action to defend ourselves if civilians may be killed in the course of it, then we're completely defenseless.
Hmm. Michael O'Hanlon, how about that proposition of collateral damage in the war on terrorism?
No, I agree with most of Richard's recent points. I also agree with his point about root causes not being relevant to either dealing with Osama bin Laden or Saddam Hussein. Some of the followers of those individuals may be influenced by the breakdown of the Arab-Israeli peace process or some other set of political circumstances in the world that we may be able to change. But Saddam Hussein is not going to be in any way mollified or mitigated in his ambitions by root cause matters. Doesn't mean we shouldn't worry about them.
Sure.
On the matter of
Michael,
collateral damage, I think that it's very important to expand quite a bit our food aid. Mm. We're not doing enough there, but otherwise I agree with Richard.
On that note, thank you very much. Thank you, Michael O'Hanlon and Richard Pearl. Michael O'Hanlon is Senior Fellow for Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institute. Richard Pearl is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and Assistant Secretary of Defense, former Assistant Secretary of Defense under President Reagan. You can continue the conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Jack Beatty. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.